Well, as you know, if you were here last week and if you saw in the bulletin, the topic for today is this issue of the question of evil or the problem of evil. I was doing some research this week, just kind of looking online, on the web, different things, you know, do Google searches on problem of evil, problem of suffering, things like that. And it's interesting what comes up. I mean, along with a lot of pictures of Dr. Evil, there are some pretty significant arguments out there, just popular arguments, of people saying, this is why I could never be a Christian. I was just surprised again by how many atheist websites I came across, and this was at the top of the page, or it was at the forefront, or there was some significant icon or some image that was used. One thing I was, I guess, surprised by a little bit is how, in a sense, re-bothered I was by the issue. Dealing in apologetics, it's easy to kind of get to the point where you sort of think, well, I've got all the answers, and so I'm not as emotionally bothered by it. And I was struck by, again, this weekend, just how bothered I was by this issue. Just sometimes just by images, just by pictures. And some of those bothersome ones I didn't bring in here, I'm not putting in here. But as I looked at pictures, I was looking just last night as I was kind of looking over some notes, saw an image I'd never seen before, four surviving children from Auschwitz. And I just looked at it for about 5 minutes, this image, and was angry, was at people, and even kind of, you know, began to say, God, maybe I don't understand this. It's bothersome to me. I don't like it. This is probably the hardest issue for me to deal with. It's something that I'm not comfortable with. I don't like the ideas. It's not to say that I don't think there are decent answers. I think there are. But it's still troubling at the end of the day. And this is kind of what we'll flush out here both today as well as next week, is I think it's the best possible answer. I think the answer that God gives through the Bible is the very best explanation, does the most justice, gives the most dignity to human suffering and all those different elements than any other possible answer we could find out there. But it's still heart-troubling to us that we have to go through that. And if we don't feel that, I don't think we've really come in contact with it, with the argument. I don't think we've really dealt with it. So what we'll see is this isn't just an intellectual debate. It's not just an intellectual question. It is a heart debate, a heart question. There's emotions should be pretty charged here, I think. I think that's a normal and a good response, I think, in dealing with this. Let me give you guys one resource as a suggestion, and that is C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain. How many of you have had a chance to read this book or even pick it up before and read through some of it? C.S. Lewis really has two good works on this issue of evil and suffering, one of them being very, I don't want to just say academic because it's not like it doesn't touch on the heart at all, but at the beginning of The Problem of Pain, Lewis wrote it earlier on in life before he had really experienced a whole lot of pain, but I think he still does a marvelous job addressing the intellectual side of it. In fact, he says at the beginning, he says, the only purpose of this really is to address the intellectual side of it. But he does a little more than that. But those are his claims. Now, his journal that he kept after his wife, Joy Davidman, died just a few short years, very painful death of cancer, A Grief Observed, is more of his heart struggle with the issue. But The Problem of Pain is one that I would really highly encourage you to pick up if this is something that you really want to think through. And I think that knowledge can seep down into the heart. It can affect the heart as well. But I encourage you to pick that one up. I think it's really helpful. Let me read for you a quote here that will maybe bring this issue to the surface a little bit. It certainly doesn't do justice to it. In the book A Severe Mercy, the author Sheldon writes this: if only villains got broken backs or cancers, if only cheaters and crooks got Parkinson's disease, we should see a sort of celestial justice in the universe. But as it is, a sweet-tempered child lies dying of a brain tumor. A happy young wife sees her husband and child killed before her eyes by a drunken driver. And we soundlessly scream at the stars, why, why? A mention of God, of God's will, doesn't help a bit. How could a good, a loving God do that? How could he even let it happen? and no answer comes from the indifferent stars. This is a problem that is just relentless. I recently finished reading another good book. I think it's referenced in sort of the very end of your notes on suggested reading. Is Philip Yancey's book, Where is God When It Hurts? And again, just a wonderful wrestling with the question, brings out so many helpful nuggets and points. But I noticed in there, his very first chapter is entitled A Problem That Won't Go Away. It's something that's constantly on the landscape of our minds, let alone the questions that are thrown at those who hold to the idea that there is an all-loving, all-good God. And it's interesting, even the Bible wrestles with it. You know, let alone we can think of the book of Job, an entire book dedicated to the issue, and we could spend hours in here looking at what are the ideas that are latent within this book. What conclusions does Job come to? Does God give any answers to it? But look at Psalm 73. The Psalms are a book in which the Hebrew writers just constantly wrestle with these hard issues. And he's wrestling with an issue like this. The psalmist says, "This is what the wicked are like, always carefree. They increase in wealth. Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence." He's talking about there's this disproportion between those who do good and are not rewarded and those who do wicked and aren't rewarded either. They don't get their just deserts. And he's, why? Why is there not a celestial justice to this world here now? Why is there evil? Not just evil, why is there suffering, pain? What we're talking about is this. The sort of theology proper word for this is theodicy. A theodicy is basically any attempt to try to give a justification for God in the light of a world in which there's just rampant moral evil and natural evil, and we'll talk about the distinction between those two things right there. So what we will do in this somewhat is give different theodicies, different reasons why it's still both reasonable and it's logical and compelling to still believe in this loving, good, powerful, wise God, and yet not deny evil, not have to close our eyes to it. You know, be like the see no evil, hear no evil, just say it's not there. But recognize it really is there, but we can still, I think, make sense of a God who exists in this sort of world. Well, what are we talking about? Different kinds of evil. There are really two problems. There's the intellectual problem of evil, and by that we mean this concerns how to give a rational explanation of the idea that this God and evil can both exist at the same time in the same way. Okay, that's a logical problem, some people would assert, and we'll deal with that. But there's also the emotional problem, and I think they're very, very close, but we still need to be able to distinguish the two. The emotional problem concerns how to comfort those who are suffering and how to dissolve the emotional dislike people might have of this God who would allow this kind of evil. And I liked, I think it was Lee Strobel in his book, The Case for Faith, he has a whole chapter in there about evil and dealing with this problem, and he says, anytime that we as ministers of the gospel are talking about this issue with a friend or a coworker or whoever that might be, we need to distinguish between these two. If someone brings this issue up and you start saying, well, actually, I think there's a very logical reason that God can coexist with evil, but it's a heart issue, it's the emotional, he says, we're missing it. That's not it. Now, they may get to that point, but he said, I'm always very, very careful, as Strobel says, to try to diagnose, is this an emotional objection or is it a logical objection? Because they're both there. So I think it's important for us to know those two categories. Does that make sense? Well, what do we mean by evil? Let's try to get a little bit more specific, try to define our terms. There are two kinds of evil in the world. And this, I think, is our first blank here. There's what we would call moral evil. Moral evil is evil done by people's own inhumanity to other people, maybe motivated by hate or greed, overindulgence, and so on. There's also what you can think of as just natural evil. Both these, I think, are tough to deal with. These are disasters brought about by natural causes, floods, earthquakes, tornadoes, different sorts of even, diseases and things along those lines. And obviously, sometimes these two things are intertwined. We can think of a lot of cases in which a government would use food as a political weapon, and so there's in a sense a natural disaster. There's famine as a result of some political tyrant not allowing it. So there are the mixture of moral evils and natural evils in that sense. Someone's dying of starvation because another person withholds food or something along those lines, or withholds water. But what is it? What are we talking about? What is evil? Well, different worldviews. You guys remember the first couple weeks, if you were here, we talked about the general worldviews. What were they? We only said three is sort of the lowest common denominator.
Naturalism.
Naturalism, which is basically what? What is naturalism, real quick? Naturalism is basically random chance, atheism. Okay. Atheism is the negative side, naturalism is the positive side. Atheism says there is no God. Well, what is there? Naturalism says just nature. The natural world, the natural order, that's all that exists. So that worldview is going to give one answer. And this is also an interesting thing, and that's why I started with worldviews, is to be able to go back to worldviews and look at how does each worldview address this question. That's what I said earlier, in that I think Christianity addresses it better. Christianity's answer isn't totally satisfying to me. Problem is, the others are not in the least satisfying to me. So naturalism will have an answer, and then there's the pantheism. All is God, all is one, new age, everything is divine. And that's going to have an answer too. Both of them are going to be real cheap on it, I think. Well, here's basically how a lot of different perspectives come down on this issue of evil. Because again, defining terms is the first duty of intelligent people. That's where we need to start. Well, some people would say evil is an illusion. Non-dualistic Hinduism, Christian Science holds this idea. There's no such thing as sickness. It's an illusion. Mary Baker Eddy was the founder of Christian Science. Problem being that she, of course, died. Doesn't really make a whole lot of sense within that. New Thought Metaphysics. Certain Eastern, a lot of pantheism holds that evil is an illusion. Not all of it. Either it's a total illusion, or they say, well, it's really part of God. Because all is one, all is eternal, so if it's real, it's got to be co-equal and co-eternal with God. And so you have almost, this is what goes on in some forms of Hinduism as well. Another option about evil is to say evil is sort of basic to human existence. It's a brute fact. Or it's unexplainable. Buddhism holds to this idea. Evil is just hardwired into the way that the world is. If you saw the movie The Matrix, one of the people from The Matrix was trying to explain why the designers of The Matrix couldn't make it perfect. And he said, it's impossible. It's hardwired into the system. It's just the way the world is. You can't get around it. Or we could say, evil exists because matter exists. Spirit is what's good. It's matter. It's our bodies. It's the physical world that brings evil. Unfortunately, this creeps its way into Christian theism at times. This was an idea that was held kind of by Plato, by some of the early Greeks, by later Greek ideas called Gnosticism. Some of the ideas that Dan Brown mentions in his book, The Da Vinci Code, he talks about Gnosticism. They held the idea that matter's bad, spirit's good, some kind of things along those lines. A guy who I'll mention here in a minute, St. Augustine. Augustine was a guy who left a religion called Manichaeanism to become a Christian. This is like in the 300s. And after Paul the Apostle, this guy was probably one of the best explainers of Christianity, systematizers of here's what the Bible teaches. But he was bugged by the issue of the problem of evil, and he was a Manichaean, and he thought this is ridiculous that just matter's evil, physical stuff is evil and spirit's good, and so he left that, came over to Christianity as a result of not being able to explain it that way. Number four, evil is the result of two equal powers. This is sort of a Star Wars picture. There's the good side of the force, the bad side of the force. Taoism, you've seen that yin-yang symbol before, haven't you? Where it looks like the two teardrops. There's the black teardrop and the white teardrop. That's the picture of that. It's two co-equal, co-eternal powers battling each other, but they really have to stay together. It's not the idea that you want good to overcome. You just want balance. Balance in the force, as the Star Wars series talks a lot about. Number five, evil is the result of determinism. What we mean by that is God's will. Now, some atheistic views could hold this, like fate. You hear a lot of people talk to this day about fate. Fate's talked about all of it. It's in songs. It's in country songs. It's in music, whatever. That's kind of the idea that there's something in control. It's just determined to happen no matter what you can do. Islam is an example of a religion which holds the idea that God has just chosen evil for people. And so if there are three doors and God asks you to pick, it doesn't matter which one you pick. The lion which will devour you will be behind whichever one you pick. It's just determined to happen. You don't really have a choice in it. It's what God wants. Another explanation is evil exists because God is either, and this is what we'll get into here in a minute, because this is where the logical objection comes in, where a lot of atheists bring up a very logical objection. Either God is limited, meaning he'd like to destroy evil, but he just can't. He's not able to. He's impotent in that way. Or he's wicked. He could destroy evil, but he just doesn't want to. He likes it, maybe, for some reason or another. He's a sadist. He wants to see that sort of thing go on. Two examples of that, I have, I guess, kind of switched there. Rabbi Harold Kushner, he wrote a book entitled Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Very, very popular, very famous book, and I think there are a few helpful things in there. But his ultimate conclusion is, what do we do to this logical argument that we're going to look at in a second here? And he says, we just have to scrap the idea that God's all-powerful. God is a very all-loving God, but he's in a sense finite. This is oftentimes what's called finite godism or finite theism. The idea that God would love to destroy evil if he could, he just doesn't have the resources. Hinduism holds the idea that, well, either God is, there's a part of God that's wicked, or there are other gods that are wicked, something along those lines. You guys, I would suggest that all of these options are absolutely unsatisfactory. None of them do justice to it. And we could go a lot more in-depth with each one of these, but I think just that looking at it, probably most of us are saying, just doesn't really solve the issue of what evil is at its root. How do we explain it? Well, how does Christian theism explain evil? This is basically how Christianity attempts to explain it. The Christian definition of evil is this: evil is a lack or twisting of an already existing good. The word that was used by Augustine, that's used on theological terms, is privation. It's a privation of the good. It's a removal of some piece of the good, and it leaves the good less than perfect. Or it's a breaking, it's a bending. And so the good is still there, but it's perverted. That's what the word to pervert means. It's somehow twisted. But it doesn't mean it's totally gone. We go to Genesis chapter 1, and this is the biblical account. Genesis chapter 1, chapter 2. God creates the universe. He creates all things physical. He creates human beings who are both physical and non-physical, or immaterial and material beings. And what is the statement about it all? Good. In fact, when it gets to humanity, we read it as very good. So God's creation as it stands, including all things, work, labor, everything that's there, it's all good. Childbirth, everything is good that is there. The problem, okay, you say, all right, fine, well, how do we get what we got? Well, the author tries to answer that in Genesis chapter 3. And he says there's this sin, this rebellion against God, taking up arms against God. And as a result, pain enters the world. Suffering enters the world. So that's the Christian definition. Now, why is that so different than the rest of it? Well, look at it this way. Think of it this way. Listen to some words by Augustine on what evil is. And basically what he says here is evil is not a thing that you can just look at. Like, here's evil, and there's no good there. It's pure evil in a sense. He says this: good can exist without evils. For instance, Genesis 1, Genesis 2. Evils, on the other hand, cannot exist without goods, because the nature in which evils exist are good insofar as they are natures. Moreover, evil is removed not by removing any nature or part of a nature that evil brings to a thing, but by healing and correcting what evil has damaged and deformed. Now, this, I think, is significant, because what the Christian understanding is, and if this is a little heady, let's try to unpack it here a little bit. What Christianity claims is that evil is not an entity that can exist. You can't create something that is pure evil. You know how you get evil? First you create something good, and then you pervert it. And then you have something that's evil. But evil isn't something that, in a sense, can be created. It's not a thing in and of itself. So to say, to ask a question like, why did God create evil? Evil's not creative, it's destructive. You cannot create a lack, can you? Here's a couple sort of non-moral examples. How many of you have seen a hole before? A hole. Where did you see the hole?
Surrounded by matter.
Okay.
You see the matter first before you see the hole.
You saw the hole in something, in some matter, right? It might have been, you know, we talk about holes in our head, right? We're talking, there's a lack or something along those lines. How many of you have seen rust? Where was it?
A piece of iron.
It was a corrosion of metal of some sort, or rot. Rot on an apple, okay? You cannot create rot. You can't create rust. You can't create a hole, can you? How do you get a hole? You remove the good nature that is there. Now, these are non-moral examples, but I'm trying to give a concrete example so we can think a little bit more abstract and think of moral reality, okay? So what you do is first you take a good thing, and then you remove something and you have a hole, or you pervert it, you change something chemically, and you have some sort of a distortion. That's what evil is. You can't just say, I'm going to create a hole. That doesn't make sense. Because according to the Christian understanding, evil is to remove, it's to lack some good, or it's to pervert some good. It's a privation of the good. So that is, I think, the very best way to understand it. And really, I think that's the only way that makes sense. As we dialogue with those who would hold to an atheism or a pantheism, and you ask that question, what is evil? What you will find is they will give examples of it. It's hatred, it's bitterness, it's envy. But when you say, well, what is it? Define it. Don't give examples. Define. There is no other explanation, I don't think, that works at all besides a lack or twisting of the good. It's the only thing I think that makes sense. And that is what's laid down in Genesis 3. It's the perversion of the original good. The original tent in our relationship with other people. Remember, God talks about, here are the consequences of sin. And what does he talk about? He says, it's all of the good things. And sometimes we say, oh, these are bad things now. No, they're still good. Work and labor. Some people think that came after the fall. Work and labor. Remember, the job was to cultivate, right? Build the garden. Move from a garden to a city. Genesis to Revelation. Build, create culture, cultivate, work. Now he says, now that will only happen by sweat of your brow. Difficulty in it now. Childbirth, right? There to cultivate, to populate the world. Good thing. But now it's only going to come through pain. And then he even addresses the idea of animosity between husband and wife. Everything's out of joint. Everything's broken now. But all those evils only came as a result of the good somehow being bent, somehow being twisted, or out of order in some way. Does that make sense? Any responses to that or comments? Yeah.
Because one thought is, why couldn't it be the opposite? Why couldn't it be evil to some parts of good? Is it because of Genesis 1 and 2? Is that the only reason, or are there others?
Couldn't it go the other way around?
Just like a, say the whole is good and that around it is evil.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so, not just because Genesis 1 and 2, that's a good question, but also because I don't think it makes sense to talk about, because anytime you give it, like if I say, okay, you know, tell me something, a whole, well, you can't start with the whole. You have to start with the matter or the wood or something first before you get the whole. So I don't think it makes sense to talk about evil outside of good. If there were no sun and therefore no eyes to see it, would we know that there's darkness? Would the concept of darkness make sense? No, it would just be, I mean, we couldn't even get it. It would be a category we wouldn't understand, right? I think that's a good way to think about it. So I don't think you can go that way. I think you have to go the good, pervert it, and then you have evil. Because anytime you mention evil, I'm going to find somewhere in there some good that's been radically perverted. Look at the ultimate example, person-wise. Satan. Satan is possibly the most evil, morally evil being, only because he was one of the greatest beings, having all these powers and goods. So you can only get the greatest evil by first having the greatest good. Does that make sense, kind of? Or does that answer or address the question? Okay. Still more?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you're saying, given this analogy, people with like these physical things like a hole or rust, what if they like bring up something like Holocaust? Like how do you fit in like, oh, well that was good, it was just converted, like what, you know, if there's any good in that, like how can you even say what, you know what I'm
saying? That's a great example. When we talk about the Holocaust, that's not a natural evil. That's a moral evil, meaning someone's moral choices, their will, acted upon others to destroy. Primarily, we would trace that back to the person of Adolf Hitler. Well, that's an example of a will gone bad. Again, I think pretty similar case to sort of a, you know, the Satan example. You know, the example that I always think is a good one as far as understanding that to get really bad evil, you've got to start with good, really good intent. Compare, you know, my two favorite examples as far as, you know, criminals. Hannibal Lecter, okay, if you've seen the movie Silence of the Lambs, which I'm not encouraging you to go see it, but Hannibal Lecter is this hideously awful criminal. Well, why is he such a bad, why is he so hard to catch? He's so intelligent. He's a brilliant mind. He has insight and clarity into other people's lives and psyches and all this stuff. Well, that differs from the guy that I heard about 5 years ago who was a crook in Denver, and he got caught because you remember those old tennis shoes that when you step they have, you know, the little red, you know, like lights that glow up in the back of the heel? Well, he was robbing a house at nighttime wearing his shoes with the little glowing things on the back. So the cops just slowly and steadily chased him until he was tired. You know, he couldn't get away because he was, you know, had a glow on his shoes. Not the brightest guy in the world. Not the kind of guy who's going to make a good crook. What makes a good crook? A brilliant person. They're going to be the best crooks. What's going to wreak the most devastation? Some sort of greatness that has been perverted and gone bad. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other comments on that or thoughts? Yeah. His evil has become his good, yeah. And see, I think that's a result of the perversion. Who knows?
But he's going to say, he's going to say that the perversion is the good.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't have a problem with that, but I mean, it goes back to who's going to have the most insight, a drunk person or a sober person? The sober person. The Bible talks about sin as being like a drunken stupor. It intoxicates us to the point where we no longer are able to rightly discern. Because that's the idea that, you know, total depravity is the doctrine that sin pervades itself into every aspect. Our noetic structures, our mental abilities, our rationale, our abilities to discern and interpret and think. So if that's true, even though Satan still has possibly one of the greatest minds created, there are things that are going to be wrong there. They're going to be, you know, even though he doesn't have a literal brain, synapses, so to speak, that aren't firing right, aren't connections that are rightly made. So even though someone can say, evil is my sin, is my good, I mean, I think they're just wrong. They're deluded. They're like the intoxicated person who is convinced that this is the best state of life, but who knows the best state of life best, a sober person or a drunk person? That's a good question, though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really does. It really does. And again, this is why I say I am compelled by the answers Christianity gives to evil. And I'm more of a Christian because of evil, even though I'm more dissatisfied every time I look at evil. But it's the only thing that can make sense of it in my mind. Yeah.
Before the fall of Satan, before angels were created, did evil exist, or was that the beginning of evil, or was the potential of evil present before that?
Yeah, I think the right way to think about it is God created the possibility of evil because he created free beings to choose. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as far as in a theodicy or a justification of evil in the light of God. So God creates the potential for evil. Angelic beings, some, and all humans actualize that potential in our actions. So did evil exist? Apparently it didn't exist potentially before the created beings, for instance, even before the world. Because it seems as though angelic beings were created prior to the universe. Prior to angelic beings' creation, if there were no other creations besides them, and God is the greatest possible being. He is perfect love, perfect justice. Remember the New Testament says it is impossible for God to lie. It's the idea that his character restrains him. He is a being which cannot be false. He cannot be evil. So prior to that, not only was evil non-existent, it was impossible. But as soon as finite created moral beings are there, potential, it's there. Because the moment there's free will choice, there's at least the possibility of evil. Even if it's never actualized. Had Adam and Eve done something different, it never happened. I can't quite imagine how and what that would look like, but it would still be possible. Well, we read of Satan's fall as being pride, as being one of not too different than the reasoning he gave to Adam and Eve in the garden. You can be like God. Wanting to, in a sense, be the ruler of his own destiny. Yes. But that's not how he was created. I think pride is a perversion of the right situation as I know my place in the order of things. God, me, others, and that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Do you guys understand the question? How is it that in eternity we will not sin again? Because we know we won't. There will be no imperfection, no injustice in eternity. We will be perfected beings. But yeah, we talk about free will being in this. If there's free will and we're not going to turn into robots, the other side of eternity, how are we going to do it? And that's one of those issues that the Bible doesn't address. I wish it did. We just know it won't happen. Now, I think there are some good speculative ways to make sense of it. One of the best I've ever heard, one of the ancient Christians talked about, if this is true, I don't know. If it's not true, it should be, because it's such a good argument. he said he understood the fall of, because he reasoned the same way. He thought if a being standing literally before the fullness of God, and if you were fulfilled with God, there would be no possibility of I want something else, because you would be fulfilled. It's like being hungry and wanting something else to eat. It wouldn't happen. Even if it's logically possible, it wouldn't happen. So he reasoned and said, well, Adam and Eve didn't seem to have a full picture of who God was. Otherwise, they couldn't have doubted. So they seemed to be in some way limited. I mean, there was, even though it talked about God walking with them in the cool of the day, there was still must have been some type of a curtain, and obviously they didn't fully understand God or have a full picture of him, because faith was still required. That, you know, don't eat this. I've just got to take him on his word. I can't see the full picture for myself. This thinker reasoned that angelic beings were probably in a similar relationship in their initial creation. And there was this testing period with angelic beings in which it was said in some way, follow me, follow my, as I think it's J.R.R. Tolkien kind of writes in an analogous way in one of his books, do this symphony, I've written the music, you follow this piece. They don't have full understanding though. There's this testing time. Some rebel, some want to play on their own. Others follow the conductor, and then after that point it is fully revealed who God is, after this testing, in a sense ensuring people's true freedom, you can love me or not. So maybe it's the idea that if we were to fully see God, in a sense it's just impossible but to love and but to serve. Now, is that true? I don't know, but that would at least answer the issue of in eternity the veil's finally fully removed and I am fulfilled. Every single want and desire is met and continues to be met. So while it's logically possible I could sin, it's absolutely improbable. And not just like 90% chance I won't. That's not what I mean. I'm talking about statistics. By improbable, I mean there would be no reason to. The desire, yeah, well, because desires are fully met. I choose evil and I choose lesser things because I think they will fulfill me because I'm not here, right? Someone who commits some sort of an act of a betrayal, you know, say in a marriage situation, they commit adultery or something along those lines, or They do it because I'm not fulfilled. I don't think I can get fulfilled here, so I will get fulfilled here. Well, if I am fully fulfilled, if that's not redundant, there would be no reason to turn to a lesser good. It would be like, you know, drinking, you know, cherry Coke for me and then someone offering me a Diet Coke. Is it logically possible I will drink the Diet Coke? Yes, but it will never happen. Never happen, because it's disgusting. Now, that's obviously sort of a funny illustration, but does that kind of address, and again, is that what will happen? I don't know. I think it's a good possibility. It's at least, it makes sense to me. I think, yeah, that could explain it, because I've been troubled by that same thing and wrestled with that. How will we not sin? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And doesn't the Bible talk about, you know, now we see as through a glass dimly? You know, the idea that we really don't see God fully. We have still just a sliver. I mean, even with the full revelation of the Old and New Testament and the fullest revelation of the person of Jesus Christ, he said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That's still, because we're finite and fallen, our synapses aren't fully working, I still have a sliver of who God is. I think it's a true sliver. It's an accurate sliver. But when I'm allowed into the presence and it's totally fulfilled, I'm continually learning and examining who the person of God for all eternity, as well as I think in a sense return to the garden, still building, still creating, still cultivating. All needs will be met and continue to be met. So I just don't think it'll be possible. Logically possible, but not practically possible. Maybe that's the best way to put it. But it's a great question. It's a great question. And again, that's just a guess. I don't know. But that's what I think. Well, take a look at this. Number two, here's the objection. This is the objection to the idea that God and evil both exist in the world. We just can't have them, those who object say. The Christian God in a world in which there is evil cannot coexist. Well, here's sort of the logical statement, but before we do that, let's look at what the objector is disagreeing with, what we mean. This is what the Christian means. That there is an all-powerful, that's omnipotent, omnipotent, all-powerful, and omnibenevolent, all-good or all-loving God. A God who has these two qualities, many more qualities as well, right? All-wise and other things, but at least these two, all-powerful, can do everything, and all-good, will only do the good. This sort of being exists. And evil exists. We recognize both those things. Well, the objector says, you can't recognize both those things. It's like saying, in this universe there exist two things, an immovable object and an irresistible force. They both can't exist. You have to scrap one. Well, let's look at that and see if that really is the case, if that happens. Here's the objection, and let's walk through this and try to kind of get our minds around it here, what the logical problem is saying. A, if God were all-powerful, okay, omnipotent, he could abolish evil. He would be able. Letter B, and you could switch A and B, doesn't matter what order they're in. If God were all-good or all-loving, he would want to abolish evil, or he would desire to abolish evil. Letter C, evil exists. Conclusion, God is either not A or not B, or neither A nor B. Do you follow the argument? It's a pretty tight argument, I think, as it stands. It's a difficult argument to get around. It's one that has been proposed. Heraclitus, I think, a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, first proposed this type of idea. David Hume, a thinker in more recent times, modernist. People continue. I was speaking to someone not too long ago when they were talking about taking a philosophy class. And they said, this was the first thing that was brought up. It was the first objection that was brought up. There's a logical problem. You can't have both God and evil. God who is good and loving and evil. They just don't work. Thomas Aquinas, who was during the Middle Ages, wrote a 4,000-page book entitled Summa Theologica. Can you imagine 4,000 pages? So not night reading exactly. And in his book, Summa Theologica, St. Thomas Aquinas, goes through just question, answer, question, answer, question, answer of the Christian faith, 4,000 pages. The very first question, does God exist? Because he says that's where we need to start. And he says there are only two objections to it. One is, he says, basically, well, that just sort of the physical sciences explain the universe. And he says that's not an objection, that's just saying we don't need God. The only objection, he says, that even exists is this one. God's all powerful, God's all loving, evil exists, something's wrong. Something doesn't work with it. What do you think about this? Does this argument work? Or is there something wrong?
I think it leaves out the total nature of God.
Okay. What else?
Also justice.
Okay. So how does bringing in the a third, because I would agree, I think there are a lot of other, you know, he's just, he's, you know, many, many other things. But that might almost be hidden within the all good concept. He's all good means
sure,
loving and just.
Of course,
right?
Defining what good is.
Yeah.
And it's our definition, not necessarily the full definition.
Okay. Okay, so what does it mean to be good? That's a good question. That's a very good question.
Mm-hmm. A regular basis.
Okay. So it doesn't take into account human free will.
No.
I mean, maybe the most you could say is, well, God should wipe every single person out. Right? I mean, if we're evil. If we're not, then he shouldn't. But if he's all good and we're evil, he should wipe us out right away. Evil exists, he should destroy it.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah. Think about it this way. And like I said, let this argument sink in. Because I think it's in many ways, a pretty tight argument. Again, many people have been convinced by this. I still hear people using this exact same argument. Now, I think at the end of the day, it doesn't work. I think there's a way to defeat it. There are three ways, just sort of like a little logic talk here for a second. There are three things that an argument has to have to work. And you can think of it this way. It's form, it's facts, and it's terms. For an argument to work, it has to have, number one, its form. Form means sort of premise one, premise two, conclusion. Okay, if I say all people who have lived in New Orleans have an accent, I lived in New Orleans, I have an accent. Okay. Now, the form of that works. Okay, meaning that's true. If one is true, and if two is true, three is true. The form of that works. The logic, the conclusion following from the premise. If I say, it's cold outside, I have a jacket on, therefore my jacket's blue. Okay, the form doesn't work. It doesn't follow. The blueness of my jacket has nothing to do with one and two. The form is bad. The facts is the second element. Facts means one is one and true or two. Let's give the example I gave back that I started earlier. All people from New Orleans speak with an accent. I live in New Orleans, let's say I was from New Orleans, I have an accent. Well, the form's good. Are the facts good? Is statement one true? All people from New Orleans have an accent. No, that's not the case. So it's an untrue statement. So in that case, the facts are bad. And then finally, the terms can be bad. That means one word may be ambiguous. One word may not be clear. Here's a good example. This is sort of the ongoing debate between Catholic and Protestant. And here's the argument that's given. Jesus is God. Okay. Number two, Mary is the mother of Jesus. Conclusion, Mary is the mother of God. Protestants say the word God, there's equivocation on that term, meaning when we use it in reference to Jesus, we're referring to one thing. When we use it over here, you're using it to mean something else, as though Mary is the mother. Because the word needs to be unpacked. That's the idea. You need to explain the word, so there's a problem in the term itself. And that's, I think, probably one of the biggest problems with this. Because the form is good. The facts, maybe we could say if God were all good, he would abolish evil. That doesn't address the when question. Does he need to do it the moment it arises? Could he allow it to sort of stand for a while, maybe? I mean, he'd still have to have some good if he's all good. But then there's also the term issue. What does it mean by all good? What does that mean? Does it mean he wants us happy? We've got to really define those terms. Take a look at this as we try to answer that. William Lane Craig addresses the fact question. He's addressing the issue of if God were all good, he would abolish it right now. Well, he's addressing, he's saying, not necessarily. He says this: a being is not morally culpable, meaning blamable, in allowing evil, otherwise preventable evil, to exist if that being, he's talking about God, of course, has a morally sufficient reason for allowing it. So long as it is even possible that God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting evil, it follows that God and evil are not logically consistent. Basically, what he's doing is this. One logical fallacy is to say either or. It's like the either or fallacy. Either this or that. You know, either you believe this or you believe that. There's no third option. Well, sometimes that's true. There is either or. Either you exist or you don't exist. That's true. There is no third option. What he's saying is there actually is a third option. He's saying either God's all-powerful and all-loving and he destroys evil, or he's not and evil exists. William Craig says, nope, there's a third option. Let me try to split that. God's all-powerful and all-good, but he has a morally sufficient reason for letting evil stay, even though it's corrosive and destructive, and evil exists. He says, I've solved the logical problem. And I think that does solve it in as it stands here. As long as we can say God has a good reason for allowing a good reason, that still makes sense. Do you understand kind of where Craig is going there, William Lane Craig is going there? Now, we haven't said what it is. I mean, that's a whole other battle, right? What is that reason? Why would he allow innocent suffering? Why would he allow a child to die of a disease that is preventable, or someone to be marred in some way? If it could have been prevented, why would he allow that? That's a different question. But if it's even logically possible, at least this argument is out the door. There's not a logical problem with it. And again, I spent a lot of time with it. Maybe you're sort of thinking, yeah, duh, that's not a big deal. But people, atheists, are still using this argument today and just saying Christians are absolutely illogical. So I think that's one way to split the horns of the dilemma, so to speak. But there are other things here, too. Let me give you a restatement of the argument. See if this one works. An all-good God would abolish evil unless he has a morally sufficient reason for permitting it. An all-knowing, all-wise, and all-powerful God can abolish evil. Evil exists. Therefore, God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting evil. So I think you can give a different argument that solves all the problems, and it's not illogical to believe in God and evil at the same time. So I think we can get around it, so to speak. Now again, we still haven't said what those reasons are. I want to get into this a little bit more, but I don't want to go too far over. I want to respect your time here. So let's pause here. I'm sorry, I feel sort of like we're breaking in the middle of a thought. I hate that. And we will pick up next week and finish up this concept. And next week we will get into a little bit more specifically, as I'm sure you can already see in your outline there, what are some of the explanations? Why would God allow evil? And I think there are some good reasons why he would. Let's go ahead and end in prayer, and if you guys need to leave, you can. Otherwise, we can dialogue, talk for a couple more minutes here. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this day, Lord. Thank you for the minds you have given us, Lord. We recognize we are sinful, fallen creatures, but yet you still allow us to interact with you, God. You condescend yourself. You stoop down to accept even our feeble thinking. And God, thank you for guiding our thinking. Lord, I pray that you will do that. Lord, I believe you've done that this day, even this morning, through the power of your Holy Spirit. God, go with us this day. God, would you impact us with these issues? May we feel troubled over this issue before we get it resolved. Maybe if nothing else, just to do what Christ did, to embrace suffering of others, to weep with those who weep and mourn with those who mourn. And I think that compels us to do that. So God, help us to really feel this issue, but again, don't leave us in total skepticism. Allow us to come to a good picture of who you are, because I believe that when we see even an inkling of your face, God, that it does diminish this issue. It does make sense of it to us, and I thank you that you answer both the heart and the mind. God, thank you for this day again, and we give you all the glory and all the praise. In Jesus' name, amen.